Gretel Erlichsen. She wrote The Solace of Open Spaces, and she has the ability to write about holding space with somebody when you know they're gonna die and enjoying those last moments that I haven't found anybody else able to capture. So I don't really like fun reading, obviously. I wanna feel. So those are two of my favorites.
Great, thank you. Jean, do you have any last questions?
No, I don't. So I will simply say, what a pleasure having a conversation with you this evening, Ira. An honor, yeah. And best of luck with the book and the second book, because I know it's a challenge. And yeah, thank you.
Thank you both so much.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Hi everyone, I'm Henry, and I'd like to invite you to listen to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland. My co-hosts and I are three leftist veterans that aim to expose the reality of the U.S. military's multiple wars abroad and illuminate the damage military service does to Americans and foreign citizens around the world. How can we stand by and do nothing while our military kills and destroys the lives the world over, while telling Americans that all this death and destruction protects them from terrorists, when nothing could be more false? Fortress on a Hill aims to change that. You can listen to us at 9 a.m. on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month right here on KBOO. And thanks.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, Georgia voters headed to the polls on Tuesday to choose between Republicans and Democrats for the last two undecided U.S. Senate seats. Having already captured 48 seats, the Democratic Party could gain a bare minimum control of the chamber if their candidates, Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff, win both their races against incumbents Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue. Weeks of early voting have been dominated by Democratic voters, but Republicans are expected to turn out in high numbers on Tuesday. Both races are close if polls are to be believed, and the outcomes may not be known for a few days. The GOP senators fighting to keep their seats have both backed, to varying degrees, President Donald Trump's bid to overturn the presidential election. On Monday, Loeffler took to the stage at a Trump rally, saying she would join the group of Republican senators that are objecting to the Electoral College vote.
On January 6th, I will object to the Electoral College vote.
Her opponent, Warnock, cited her stated intention on Twitter, saying she wants to, quote, undermine your vote and overturn Georgia's election. President Trump has made the Georgia Senate races about his presidential state loss, and in conflating the two, has risked lowering Republican turnout. On Monday, Gabriel Sterling, a voting system implementation manager for Georgia and a Republican, responded to the now infamous tape of the Saturday phone call that Trump had with State Secretary Brad Raffensperger. Sterling debunked Trump's wild claims point by point without mincing words and indicating just how frustrated he was with the president. "I wanted to scream," he said when he heard the Trump call, before going on to explain.
"We've seen nothing in our investigations of any of these data claims that shows there's nearly enough ballots to change the outcome. And the secretary and I at this podium have said since November 3rd, there is illegal voting in every single election in the history of mankind because there are human beings involved in the process. It's going to happen. It's a question of limiting it and putting as many safeguards as you can in place to make sure it doesn't happen. Again, this is all easily, provably false. Yet the president persists."
That's Gabriel Sterling, a top Georgia elections official, speaking on Monday at a press conference as he destroyed every single one of Trump's baseless claims about Georgia's election results. But proving once again that facts don't matter to him, Trump regurgitated the lies at his Georgia rally, which was ostensibly meant as a booster for the GOP Senate candidates. 2 days before the Electoral College votes are formally tallied, he remained adamant, saying, "I'll fight like hell to remain in power," echoing the sentiment of an undemocratic dictator. And he claimed that, quote, "everyone loved my phone call with the Georgia Secretary of State."
"The press won't report this. They're probably turning off. Oh, we don't like this. They don't like this. They don't want to talk about numbers. They talked about my phone call. They don't like my phone call. Everyone loved my phone call. They don't like talking about numbers because nobody knew the numbers were so egregious."
Meanwhile, President-elect Joe Biden, who was also in Georgia to rally behind the Democratic candidates, reminded voters in that state how they held the power now to determine which party would be in charge. Mr. Biden even tied $2,000 economic stimulus checks to the Senate races.
"If you send John and the Reverend to Washington, those $2,000 checks will go out the door, restoring hope and decency and honor for so many people who are struggling right now. And if you send Senators Perdue and Loeffler back to Washington, those checks will never get there. It's just that simple."
Biden also accused Trump of whining and complaining rather than addressing the COVID-19 pandemic.
"Getting America vaccinated will be one of the most difficult operational challenges this nation has ever faced. But we've known it for the last months. This administration has gotten off to a god-awful start. President spends more time whining and complaining than doing something about the problem." "I don't know why he still wants the job. He doesn't want to do the work."
That's President-elect Joe Biden on Monday at a rally in Georgia ahead of the Senate races there. In other news, the leader of the pro-Trump men-only hate group Proud Boys has been arrested. Enrique Tarillo was charged with destroying a Black Lives Matter banner that hung outside a black church in Washington, D.C. during a violent rally late last year, where several people were also beaten and stabbed. The Proud Boys have planned a similar gathering on Tuesday and Wednesday to protest the formal step of declaring a democratically elected president. Their plans have prompted the mayor of D.C. to mobilize the National Guard. In news from the pandemic, the U.S. continues to break records on new infections, especially in California, where 74,000 people were diagnosed on Monday alone. Los Angeles County, where this program is produced, has become the nation's leading hotspot. Now, emergency responders in L.A. are being advised not to bring COVID-19 patients into hospitals if it is clear that they are unlikely to survive. Hospitals are inundated with patients and are facing shortages of ambulances and other critical equipment. L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti explained that a new infection is estimated to take place every 6 seconds in the city, and that on average there was a death every 10 minutes. To make matters worse, an expected surge of infections from New Year's gatherings is expected to show up anytime now. Meanwhile, a new variant of the COVID-19 virus first identified in the U.S. has now been confirmed to be found in at least 4 states in the U.S. That includes New York, Colorado, California, and Florida. The new variant is significantly more transmissible. And vaccination efforts across the nation and in California are excruciatingly slow. Governor Gavin Newsom said only a third of all vaccines shipped to hospitals in California have so far been dispensed, and he vowed to do better. Reuters reports that more than two-thirds of the 15 million coronavirus vaccines shipped within the United States have gone unused. The governors of New York and Florida are now moving to penalize hospitals if they store the vaccines for too long without dispensing them. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said, "I don't want the vaccine in a fridge or a freezer. I want it in somebody's arm. If you're not performing this function, it does raise questions about the operating efficiency of the hospital." And in Wisconsin, a pharmacist who was caught having intentionally sabotaged more than 500 doses of the Moderna vaccine has now admitted to being a conspiracy theorist who believes that the vaccine is dangerous and changes people's DNA. Nations around the world are continuing or strengthening their lockdowns as cases surge outside the US too. In the UK, Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced a third nationwide stay-at-home order as cases have surged there. In Germany, an existing order enacted in December will remain in place through January as deaths mount. Back in the United States, Wisconsin is bracing itself for potential violence in the wake of two legal decisions related to last year's Black Lives Matter protests. A decision whether or not to charge a white officer accused of shooting a black man named Jacob Blake in Kenosha is expected on Tuesday. Governor Tony Evers has called in the National Guard in anticipation. And a white teenage boy from Illinois, Kyle Rittenhouse, accused of killing two BLM protesters in Kenosha, is expected to enter in his plea. The families of Rittenhouse's alleged victims have filed negligence claims against the city and county of Kenosha. And that does it for our news headlines. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As hospitals and health workers in the United States are overwhelmed by the COVID-19 pandemic, the inadequacies of our current healthcare system are more apparent than ever. Those who are uninsured but need treatment for the COVID-19 virus are seeing their costs covered by taxpayers. But uninsured or underinsured Americans with other ailments are still on the hook for the exorbitant costs of care. Now, Californians are pushing Governor Gavin Newsom to enact a Medicare for All system in the nation's most populous state as soon as President-elect Joe Biden takes office. The state has been one of the hardest hit in the pandemic. My guest is Betty Dumas-Toto, co-chair of Healthcare for All LA and an elected member of the LA County Democratic County Central Committee. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me today.
So first, let's talk about the fact that there is now a possibility for Medicare for All at the state-by-state level because, A, we have a Democratic president, or will very soon, and B, has picked a future Secretary of Health, Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra, who, assuming he's confirmed by the Senate, has expressed support for Medicare for All in the past. Are those the two conditions, along with the fact that we also have a Democratic governor in California, that I say the third condition, that makes it possible for California to adopt a system like Medicare for All?
Absolutely. There is a pathway for states, and especially a state like California, to implement, pass a bill and implement single payer because of these reasons. As we know, President-elect Biden has said that he wouldn't pass a Medicare for All bill. However, because of our Democratic leadership, we can get waivers in order to implement single-payer Medicare for All on a state level. And Xavier Becerra has been a very strong vocal supporter of single-payer Medicare for All, and he is the person that we would actually be applying to the waivers for.
So this is a long-standing call by progressives, right? There have been efforts both nationally and statewide for Medicare for All system for decades now. What has this pandemic taught us about the need for a Medicare for All system? How does the COVID-19 crisis create a greater incentive for this movement to now really bear fruit?
The situation here is that the COVID-19 pandemic and the virus is being exacerbated by our for-profit driven healthcare system, if you want to call it that. Because the focus is on profits only, it takes away from looking at the public and the public's need for healthcare. For example, PPE situation. We were not prepared for a virus, which we all know could possibly happen at any particular time, and prepared our healthcare workers, our nurses and doctors, did not have that PPE available to them.
That's personal protective equipment, such as gloves and face masks.
Exactly. And we had 1,700 healthcare workers pass of COVID. And I'm sure many of them did not have access to the proper PPE. That is one thing. If we don't have our healthcare workers, who is going to help us as individual lay people when we succumb to this virus? There has been, I believe, around, 50,000 doctors, practices have closed between March and June of 2020 because the for-profit driven system has driven them out of business. Those are healthcare workers and doctors that no longer see patients in the community that they served. This COVID virus is being driven, perpetuated and extended because we don't have a system that focuses on the healthcare of all Americans and the public.
And we know that those who contract COVID-19, because it's a pandemic that's so widespread, the government somehow, even under a Republican government, decided that it would be okay for taxpayers to cover the costs of COVID-19 tests, COVID-19 treatment. It's unfortunately not something that's as well known that that's the case. Maybe they don't want to publicize it too much. But the fact that COVID-19 coverage, healthcare coverage for that specific disease can be covered by taxpayers, but all other healthcare concerns have to be in the realm of private health insurance, seems to me to also be the sort of logical flaw that can be exploited, to make a case for Medicare for All.
Absolutely. We've always had the pushback of people, how are we going to pay for that? But in actuality, we can pay for it, and we have to. It's imperative that we do make a priority in our budget for public health, for the health of all Californians, for the health of the nation. The money is there. The money has, as we know, we saw this money go to some of the richest corporations and not get filtered down to the regular people. So how do we give so much money to corporations in the middle of a COVID pandemic disaster when healthcare, when the healthcare of the public needs to be addressed? COVID is definitely a case for a Medicare for All single payer system. We need to cover everybody. Everybody in and nobody out. This is our imperative for everyone in the country.
So let's talk about what it would take for California to enact a Medicare for All system, and what would it even mean for a state to do this? One of the factors that has always come, in addition to the, well, how will we pay for it argument that the opponents of Medicare for All raise, it is, well, all of those people who love their private health insurance are going to hate hate the government funded healthcare plans that they or plan that they now would have to be forced to accept. So how do you counter that?
That's not what a single payer Medicare for All plan is. In actuality, you will have more choice. You will have the choice of the doctors that you want to go see. Right now, we are limited to the doctors that are contracted with these insurance companies. And if you can't get into that insurance company or can't afford that insurance premium for that particular insurance, then you can't see those doctors. You won't be able to do that. It's not covered underneath your plan. Well, every doctor, every facility will be covered under a single payer Medicare for All system, period. You have choice of doctors, clinicians, that will be all will be choice. And hey, what about this? How about the doctors compete to be the best doctors and nurses that they could be, and that's the person you want to see? That is actually competition, not health insurance companies denying care and then hiding the fact that this hospital charges this much. And it's incredibly been a diversion to say that this is a government run. It is only a government financed. Single payer Medicare for All is only government financed. You have the choice of any doctor you want to go see. And believe me, I know I have a daughter that has had a health issue, and I have had to stick with an insurance plan that I could barely afford so she could see a particular specialist year after year. I have to do that. That's incredible. We know that single payer Medicare for All will cost us less money. It has been proven in other nations all around the world.
And of course, we know that people who are losing jobs because of the pandemic are losing healthcare because healthcare is linked to jobs. I mean, even people who have jobs are losing healthcare, like my colleagues and I at KPFK, who are seeing our benefits being reduced because the cost is too high. That's what we're being told. And so this is definitely, and you know, we wouldn't even be a conversation if we had Medicare for All. So what would it take? So say Joe Biden is president January 20th. What are you prescribing between that Governor Gavin Newsom do to obtain this waiver that is required from a future Javier Becerra health secretary? What's the process that needs to happen?
The process is an application. And that is what he needs to do. He needs to apply first for the 1332 waiver that is part of the Affordable Care Act. It is written into law. And that application will allow us as in California to be able to start innovating and to set up a single payer system here in California. That is just the beginning first step. And here in California in particular, I believe because we are the fifth largest economy in the world, we have as many about the population of Canada is basically the same. Canada rolled out their Medicare for All system, which is what they call it, Medicare for All, or Medicare they call it. They rolled it out province by province. So we can roll it out state by state. And especially with an economy like California's, we can actually lead the country. And we are asking Gavin Newsom to actually lead the country by establishing a single payer healthcare system here. Now, my organization, Healthcare for All Los Angeles, a local chapter of a nonprofit organization, like you had mentioned, has been in this advocacy for 25 years, and I say unfortunately 25 years because the political will is lacking here. And we have fought the good fight, and we at this time are urging the public to just see what's in front of them, see the virus for what is happening with the virus and the perpetuation and the extension of this virus as a public health issue in which single payer Medicare for all can address and possibly be a solution. I would say that we are starting a campaign. It's called the First 100 Days Campaign. And this campaign is to get Governor Newsom to make a demand, so to speak, or an urgent case that he apply first for those necessary state innovation waivers, the apply for the 1332 waiver that is in the law, the federal from federal Health and Human Resources Services within the first 100 days of the Biden administration, because that is how urgent the situation
is. And that's assuming that Becerra is confirmed within the first 100 days.
You know, we hope that he is confirmed, but put this in the process. Get this application happening.
Right.
There is no reason to not begin within the, in that first.
So they can even submit the application before the confirmation process is complete.
I believe so, but I don't know, and I don't want to speak out of turn for that. But I believe that they can. There are certain preparations for that application that need to be done, that can be done and begun here. And possibly maybe what he could do is he can employ this commission that he set up, this Healthy California Commission of some sort. He can direct them to please prepare for the application, so that when Javier Becerra was chosen and he takes office, that we can immediately put this application in. So there's a lot of ways that the governor can actually work on getting this ready to be applied for.
And so that's the first step. And then the second step?
The second step is he has to lobby his state legislators. He needs to introduce a California single-payer Medicare for all bill. He needs to promote its passage within the first 100 days. Promote it, start moving towards this. This is urgent. Take that urgency that he has seen. He has gotten on TV daily. You could see, the stress on his face. Do something for the people. The people are as stressed out as you. We're more stressed out because we have to face the public every single day in our jobs. Lay people, the grocery workers, nurses, doctors, please take that urgency. The other thing is to make a public pledge to the people of California that you will sign this legislation by 2022. And that's what we are asking. Those are the three things of our first 100 day campaign. And anyone can participate with us in this. And we want everyone to help us with this. We want all of our community activists, all of our advocacy people, all of to build this movement, all of the general public to get on board with these requests. Sign our petition that we have. We have it at hcala.org. Upload your healthcare story to your social media and tag us appropriately, and we will get that onto our website. If you are in LA, join a COVID safe caravan. We are actually going to be collaborating with the MLK organization, and we will be doing caravans starting on January 18th. California Nurses Association is going to roll out on February 6th caravans to message legislators and message Governor Newsom to begin doing this work. Immediately, the urgency that is involved. So that is what our campaign is. Our petition has those three demands, and we ask that people join our campaign. And the way to do that is those three points of signing the petition, uploading their healthcare story, and to, if you're in LA, get on a COVID-safe caravan. and on January 18th and all across the state with the nurses on February 6th.
And just, you know, Betty, here in California, where you and I are both based, I imagine that it ought not to be a very difficult thing to do in theory. We have a Democratic governor, entirely dominated Democratic state legislature. Democrats talk about putting people's needs above corporate greed. Here's a chance for them to prove it, right? I mean, but we've seen this in the past under Jerry Brown, when we had Democratic control of all branches of government in California, where the Democrats were too chicken to put forward a Medicare for All bill and pass it. We could have done it before. The only thing that's changed now is there is a different governor, and our healthcare crisis is much worse. But it seems as though the Democrats, when given the chance to do the right thing, will, you know, many of the time simply not do it.
Yes, I know. And we do still have a supermajority of Democrats in our state legislature. The governor himself has campaigned on single payer.
But he hasn't talked about that much since he's been in office.
No, he has not. So it's up to us. It's up to the public to build the movement, to basically pressure our legislatures and pressure Governor Newsom to take action, because this COVID-19 has laid bare that we are in desperate need for a healthcare system that is focused on public health and that is less expensive. It is guaranteed, and that's what a single-payer Medicare for All system will do. We need to build that movement. So I invite everybody to join Healthcare for All Los Angeles.
Can you give out the website, Betty, for where they can find that petition?
It's at healthcareforall-la.org.
That's healthcareforall-la.org. So going back to the situation with California specifically, do you think that, you know, yes, it's important for Gavin Newsom, who has pledged his support in the past for Medicare for All, to be the one to take this up. But of course, we all need Californians ourselves to pressure our own state legislatures, state legislative representatives to do this as well. I mean, that too can be done and ought to be, right? It shouldn't just all fall on the shoulders of the governor.
No, it shouldn't. He is the one who made the promise. He is the one who campaigned on it. So he needs to lead. That is first and foremost. He needs to lobby his legislators, and he needs to ask them to do the work of writing legislation, finding a piece of legislation, whatever they have to do to legislate for it and get it passed through both houses. We as people and the movement, we need to call our legislators. We need to call the governor. We need to write them. We need to move them. We need to come together with messages of our need for this. It's going to take a movement. We're going to have a lot of people that oppose us because there's a lot of money that will oppose us. However, with people power, we will get this done. And I believe that we will win single payer Medicare for All.
Now, if California does succeed in this effort, how does it increase incentive around the nation? California is the nation's most populous state. It often sets trends for national policies. Do you hope that this opens the door for a nationwide bill?
If we could lead by example and it could be done on a federal level, yes, that I believe that that we can do that, especially because we are so large and we have the fifth largest economy. However, if it were to go state by state, there are several states out there. I know New York had a state bill, single payer bill. I believe Washington or Oregon. I think Texas just introduced a state level single payer bill. It is catching on state by state. I think states are finding that it might be easier that way to go, especially with the atmosphere at our level, our federal level. And I think that it will be possible to move towards the federal government rolling this out as well.
Well, also when it comes to the Biden administration, we know that it's very important to push the Democratic leadership. I know that there's been a controversy over the past several weeks around some progressive activists wanting progressives in the House to hold hostage the speakership of Nancy Pelosi until she commits to a vote on Medicare for All. Of course, that didn't pan out. None of the members, there was no sort of concerted effort by those progressives to hold that the speakership hostage. Pelosi is now House Speaker again. And there's been some infighting on the left around this issue, right?
Yes, I've seen that happen. Personally, I think that the strategy was a good one that was suggested. I think that it could have worked. I believe that there was so much more we could have asked for. For example, H.R. 6906 is the Jayapal bill. That is a healthcare emergency act, basically to give all people without insurance or could not afford insurance during the pandemic, basically give them healthcare for free and some other things that were wrapped up into that bill. I would say they could have expanded on that to just include everybody. And if it was just framed in, we're going to do this during the pandemic, well, I would like to see the legislature, and if that would be passed in that way, I would like to see the legislators take it away down the line.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Betty, for joining us today, and good luck to you. We'll see how these first 100 days pan out, both at the national level and at the California level. Good luck to you.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Betty Dumas-Toto, co-chair of Healthcare for All LA and an elected member of the LA County Democratic Central Committee. We've been discussing the push for Medicare for All in California. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United States is built on a culture of war. We're used to glorifying the soldiers who fight and kill, the weapons that devastate, the presidents who recklessly endanger, and the symbols of patriotism and chest thumping that accompany declarations of American greatness. Speaking out against war has earned accusations of being anti-patriotic, naive, or idealistic. But what if we could change our culture from one that upholds war to one that upholds peace? My guest is Michael Knox, a psychologist and distinguished university professor emeritus at the University of South Florida and the founder of the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation. He joins me to discuss his latest book called Ending U.S. Wars by Honoring Americans Who Work for Peace. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Thank you, Sonali. Happy New Year, and thank you very much for having me on.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, it seems that we take for granted how much the U.S. glorifies war, right? I mean, when there are military flyovers and Americans dutifully go out and admire this hardware that is basically you know, used for death and destruction, we don't necessarily think, oh, what a glorious thing war is. We just accept it. It seems part so deeply woven into our culture that we just don't question how pro-war our entire culture is.
Mm-hmm. No, we don't. And in fact, the recent flyovers to supposedly thank the healthcare workers here, healthcare workers don't have the masks that they need and the gowns that they need. We don't have a vaccine. We can't even get masks in the drugstores for people. And yet the government's wasting money showing fighter jets streaking across the sky as if that's a way to honor healthcare workers. And when you think about even recent examples like President Biden, his presidential acceptance speech and his nomination acceptance speech both ended with the words, "And may God protect our troops." President Trump always ends his speech with, "God bless our mighty military," or our great military. And this is just part of our culture, and people don't even think, you know, well, why isn't he thanking or blessing teachers or healthcare workers or salespeople or tradespeople or any of the important people that make our communities work and our culture work? Instead, it's just part of what we hear every day and we don't think about it.
And I'm wondering if you think that this notion that criticizing war means that you're against the soldiers is part of the issue here. For example, there are a lot of veterans in the United States. Many of them are anti-war, some are not. For those that aren't anti-war, this sense that speaking out against war is a personal slap in their face, is that part of the problem for why we keep maintaining this pro-war culture?
Sure. That's part of the culture of war. You know, you can't attend a public ceremony, even a religious ceremony or a basketball game, even in high school, college, nationally, football games. They're always trotting out the soldiers and people stand and applaud. And that's part of reinforcing the culture of war. It would be hard to say, well, let's all applaud for the invasion of Afghanistan or Iraq, and no one would applaud for that. But they will always applaud for soldiers. And so people who speak out against soldiers are sometimes held in contempt for that. And if you speak out against war in our culture, you may lose friends, you may lose a job or a promotional opportunity. Family members might not speak to you. Or if you do things that are actively against war, you may be beaten or imprisoned or gassed or worse. So it's dangerous. There are consequences. So we need to change the culture so people feel comfortable speaking out against war. And that's the purpose of the book, Ending U.S. Wars. The purpose of the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation, which intends to make role models of the people who speak out against war.
So we have memorials to war. Let's talk about what a peace memorial is and could be. You have some designs in your book. You have advocated for such types of memorials. Tell me about this effort.
Well, the effort has three components. One is the U.S. Peace Registry, where we document what specific Americans have done to oppose war. We hold them up as role models, and we document in behaviorally specific terms what they've done so that other people can pick those things up. And also by doing it, we're trying to reinforce anti-war behavior, telling people this is good, this is something we're gonna honor in the book, on our website, uspeacememorial.org, and at the US Peace Memorial that we will build in Washington, D.C. So the second project is that we award an annual U.S. Peace Prize. Our founding members, we have a little over 400 founding members representing 44 states and the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and U.S. Virgin Islands. So we're just missing six states, people who have committed resources to support building a U.S. Peace Memorial. These people and the people who are in the U.S. Peace Registry nominate each year individuals to be considered for the U.S. Peace Prize, So that's our second project to give the annual U.S. Peace Prize. And the third project would be a monument, a national monument located in Washington, D.C., that would honor these people by having ways that they can learn about the people who are in the Peace Registry and the people who are winners of the U.S. Peace Prize, as well as hear about other Americans throughout our history who have opposed war. So the idea is to make war, to make speaking against war more socially acceptable. We need to highlight what people have done to oppose war and show cultural and leader icons of the U.S. show that they also have spoken out against war throughout our history. And as you know, our history began in war and continues in war. In my lifetime, the U.S. has invaded 30 countries. We've killed millions of people. And that is not a peaceful United States. We need to move away from that war culture. And we think the best way to do it is to honor Americans who work for peace, hold them up as role models, eventually get them into history books, make sure our young people are aware of what they've done, who they are, and hold them up as role models and someone who they appreciate.
I want to pick up on what you said about the idea of a peace prize. I mean, we have an international version of that, the Nobel Peace Prize, and there are issues with it, of course, but it is a highly coveted prize, even by warmongering leaders in the United States and other countries. And it's really interesting because you have this notion at an international level that those who work to further peace internationally should be upheld. But it's interesting that we don't have something equivalent in the U.S.
Yeah, well, we do, and that's the U.S. Peace Prize. It's been awarded for 12 years.
It's not known as well, I should say. It's not upheld as much as the Nobel Peace Prize yet.
And I sure hope the book will make it more known. But people who have won the prize are truly people who have worked against war. People like Cindy Sheehan, Denis Kucinich, Noam Chomsky, Medea Benjamin, Veterans for Peace. Ajamu Baraka has won the award. Christine Ahn won the award this year. I'm probably missing some names. Kathy Kelly.
And many of them, like, I should say, are people we've interviewed on our program at various times. Medea Benjamin, I understand, is one of them, a regular guest on this program. These are people, go ahead.
Kucinich, David Swanson, Denis Kucinich, Chelsea Manning. I mean, these are, some of them are household names and others are not, but these are role models whose work can be reviewed in the U.S. Peace Registry, which is part of the book. Medea Benjamin, for example, there are four pages dedicated to her work, and people can look at that. They can look at it online in the EPUB, and they can actually click on links and hear her speeches, read her articles, see her in action, and she can become a role model in that way.
So we have a situation here in this country where there are plenty of people who work for peace, plenty of people opposing war, organizing against war. They are not, most of them, household names. They are often seen as troublemakers by the powers that be, and those include the mainstream media, which then filters into the American public at large. And so this culture of celebrating peacemakers, who are sadly the ones seen as the troublemakers rather than the ones working to end violence, what is the way to make that culture of peace a more solid idea? Is this something that that can be done through private efforts? Do we need to infuse it into our government, pushing elected officials to back efforts or taxpayer-funded efforts to, say, you know, back the peace memorial, et cetera?
No, I don't think government back, because the government would is not really anti-war and never has been. So We have founding members, people who have made donations. We have donations ranging from $100 to $35,000. Fundraising needs to pick up, but having the monument so that people can see and read about and learn about these cultural icons is a way to elevate and change our culture. If you, in my lifetime, I've seen the civil rights movement make significant changes. And during that time, early on, the people who were advocating and agitating and being activists for civil rights were considered pariah. They were considered criminals. They were beaten by the police. Many people thought that they were troublemakers. Most people thought they were troublemakers. But nowadays, the civil rights leaders are held up in great esteem and are held up as role models. And I think the same thing can happen regarding war, because the Defense Department and the CIA are burning through billions of dollars every year in order to kill people. And we have needs in healthcare, we have needs in disease prevention and control and education and climate change. We have all kinds of needs in this country and that require these funds. And I think it is possible to make a cultural change that will allow us to start focusing more on peaceful things rather than killing people in foreign countries. And incidentally, the people that we kill are mostly poor people. They have no means to defend themselves, and there's no reason to suspect that these people would ever be in a position to attack the United States. And yet we kill them every day. And the Council on Foreign Relations came up with a number of over 26,000 bombings that we conducted in Obama's last year, 2016, killing people in 7 different countries.
And this is, of course, a Nobel Peace Prize winner.
Yeah, a Nobel, exactly, getting back to that. So when you think about it, I mean,
and of course, Trump too escalated wars greatly. There's no question about that.
Yeah, we don't get the data about that as easy as it was to come by. But during 2016, that was 3 bombs dropped every hour, 24 hours, 7 days a week, essentially on poor people. And these are predominantly Muslim nations that we were bombing. And if any other country did that, that would be labeled as genocide. We need to get more information to Americans about what our government is doing and who is working against it. And I think it will naturally happen that the people who are working against it can start being elevated in our society to be considered the true heroes that they are.
So there is some information about what Trump did. He tripled the pace of the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan when he first took office. And last year, or rather in 2019, he dropped a record number of bombs on Afghanistan, increasing civilian death tolls. So unfortunately, the warmongering tends to be a bipartisan project. Now, I want to pick up on what you were saying earlier around linking the funding for wars to the lack of funding for human needs right here in the United States. We've just had, in the last few weeks, a very easy, you know, two-party vote on a defense appropriations bill that threw hundreds of billions of dollars at our Defense Department, but couldn't come to an agreement on just basic and not even adequate enough $2,000 checks for Americans. And we have seen the pace of vaccination inordinately slow as thousands of Americans die every day from the COVID-19 virus, hospitals overwhelmed. How much could it help change the culture of war by linking the cost of war to the lack of funding for human needs?
Well, many of the people we honored do just that. And I think that's exactly what we have to do. We have to continually expose this. And it's very hard to do because a lot of the killing, maybe 30 to 40% of the killing we do overseas is done by the CIA, and their budget is hard to understand what that even is. And it seems to be unlimited. And I think Americans need to be more aware of what their government is doing in their name. When I was growing up, I was born exactly 9 months to the day after the US bombed Nagasaki. And when I was growing up in school, we often talked about how could the German people have let these atrocities occur, the invasion of countries, the genocide. We often discussed that in classes. And you know, we couldn't understand it. And now I see the American people just sitting back and letting their government do pretty much exactly the same thing. As I say, we've invaded 30 impoverished countries with no ability to fight back in my lifetime. We've killed millions of people. We're involved in genocide at this moment, as far as I'm concerned. And yet the American people stand there and they elect the same kind of people. They elect Democrats and Republicans who are great supporters of war. And that continues, and we need to call attention to that. And so what I want to do is to honor, recognize, and make role models of the people who have the courage to speak out against that, in hopes that we can increase the number of people that speak out against it, just like happened during the Civil Rights Movement. Mm-hmm. It's suddenly unacceptable to do what the United States was doing.
I want to go back to what we started our conversation with, which is that because the soldiers themselves are upheld as personifications of war, speaking out against war is seen as being anti-veteran, anti-soldiers, you know, insulting the troops. I'm wondering how that conversation can change. I mean, of course, one way is by upholding the veterans themselves who are anti-war. But in general, I'm wondering if you think that there's a way for us to talk about our anti-war sentiments while making clear that it's not about the individuals who are sent to fight the wars.
Well, in this culture, it's very difficult to do. I personally think that Veterans for Peace, and there are three or four other really strong anti-war groups that are made up of veterans, that their story is the story that we need to have told. And Veterans for Peace was the winner of the U.S. Peace Prize several years ago, and one of the groups we honor. And I think it's more important that these veterans talk about it. I've spoken at the annual conference of Veterans for Peace three times, and the audience was 400 to 500 people each time. There are a lot of veterans who are opposing the current wars and are frankly ashamed of their participation in previous wars, and they are trying to share this with young people, and that's what they need to do. And I think that many of the people that go into the military are looking for education, they're looking for a job. They're not looking to kill people, and they're being trained and essentially brainwashed to become soldiers that aren't too concerned about killing people.
And of course, bringing that up to a pro-war veteran may end up just alienating them, telling them they've been brainwashed. But
because if you think of things, they have great health care, and they have great educational programs, and they have all kinds of incentives, financial incentives, right, for the soldiers at the lowest levels. They're paid very well compared to other jobs available. And when you think about that, that tells us what we need is health care for all Americans. What we need is free college education for all Americans. We can give other opportunities for these people rather than becoming soldiers. And we can let war is not the answer.
Finally, are there other countries where a culture of peace has been fostered successfully that can offer a model for the United States?
Well, it's interesting. I've had lots of contacts from Latin America and from Europe asking how we can be a model for that, the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation, because they're facing the same thing. But if you look at all the countries in the world, that 200 plus countries in the world, very few of them have invaded other countries. it's a handful compared to the 200. So I can't say they have a culture of peace, but they are not invading their neighbors' countries and dropping bombs on their people. The United States is in a rare group. We're the country with the most nuclear weapons. We're the only country that's used them. We use chemical weapons all the time. Napalm, Agent Orange, and many others, gases. And we are the leader in these wartime things. And yet, the American people continue to fund it.
I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to that website from our site later today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Michael Knox, a psychologist and distinguished university professor emeritus at the University of South Florida and the founder of the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation. We've been discussing his new book, Ending U.S. Wars by Honoring Americans, Work for Peace. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Kitsap. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO, Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
Thank you, KBOO supporters, for helping us